So for today, we are going to carry on this theme for the month of November. It's basic theosophical propositions. And today's topic is reincarnation, the doctrine of hope. Reincarnation, the doctrine of hope. It will be carried out as a panel. There'll be two different presentations. And at the end of that, all contributions and questions are invited. And please, when you make a, if you have a question, please tell us who you're directing the question or contribution to. Both panelists can and will answer, but it's just a matter of to get it started who you're talking to. Okay. So the first topic that we're going to consider on reincarnation is what reincarnates. And then the second topic will be why? Why do we reincarnate? As in, what is the purpose for it? So we'll begin with a short reading here from Isis Unveiled, where we learn, HBD tells us from the remotest antiquity, mankind as a whole, have always been convinced of the existence of a personal spiritual entity within the personal physical man. This inner entity was more or less divine according to its proximity to the crown. More or less divine is the inner man. And the crown she's referring to is our highest nature, our highest illumined spiritual nature. The closer the union of the inner man to the crown, the more serene is man's destiny, the less dangerous are his external conditions. This belief is neither bigotry nor superstition, only an ever-present instinctive feeling of the proximity of another spiritual and invisible world, which, though it be subjective to the senses of the outer man, is perfectly objective to the inner ego. The inner man. Furthermore, the ancients believed that there are external and internal conditions which affect the determination of our will upon our actions in life. The ancients rejected fatalism, which implies a blind course of some blind power, but they believed in a destiny, a karmic destiny, which from birth to death, every man is weaving thread by thread around himself. So when a student takes up the project to learn a little more about reincarnation, or on the first time we do, as we study, we're going to come across a couple of concepts that we'll touch on in this meeting. And the first two are the idea of a person, a human being is comprised of a personality and an individuality. And then the other, we'll talk about the dual aspect of mind. So very simply, when we talk about the personality, if we consider the theosophical teaching that we are a sevenfold being, and there is the physical, mortal side of us, and there's the spiritual, metaphysical side of us, we can break that down real quick into, well, actually, there's the side of us that's mortal, and that's the physical body, but it's also some of our metaphysical principles, such as the astral body, that's mortal, our vitality, and our desires, kama. So that's, so to speak, here today and gone tomorrow. Okay, but if we're asking the question, well, what reincarnates? This other idea, as we said, there's personality, and then there's the individuality. And theosophy makes this distinction because the individuality is that part of us who we actually, in our true nature, who we really are, which lives and moves and passes from life to life, gaining experience and fulfilling the purpose of the soul. This is the individuality. And in short, that individuality is comprised as a macrocosm of the universe of Atma, which is the absolute spiritual side of us, for lack of better words, we're just going to say that. And the vehicle of Atma, which is Buddhi. Buddhi is that aspect of the human being wherein the faculties or powers of wisdom, intuition, and compassion are found. Those are spiritual powers. And then there's the mind. And the mind is that place in the human being that ideates, that thinks, that takes action. The three are one, and the one are three. This individuality, we also call the ego, the spiritual ego. We also call it the inner man. So that being considered, the individuality and the personality, there's also that idea that the dual nature of mind, the dual nature of the Manas principle. And Manas has a dual nature because with each incarnation, when we incarnate, the entire spiritual being at this stage of evolution on Earth is not able to incarnate fully with full consciousness. But it's the mind, a portion of the mind, kind of like a wedge, incarnates and is kind of anchored into desire. And that's what we call the lower portion of the mind, and low does not mean bad. Low means the lower portion of the mind has to do with logic and reason and figuring out what's going on in this, with all these infinite variations of the world. Unfortunately, at the same time, that lower mind is embedded in desire. And that's our animal nature. So if our will is not strong enough, then we are deceived into believing that it is better to follow the lower animal nature than the higher. So that's the lower side of mind. Now, the higher side of mind has to do with that illumined aspect of mind, which is always there, always lit by the spiritual nature of Buddhi. That is our access to intuition. That is the source of universal principles that we can apply in life if we're thinking straight, if we identify ourselves, you know, the more we identify ourselves as immortal spiritual beings with access to these higher principles, the more we're able to affect the world for good and unity. The more we ignore that side of ourselves, which is the tendency in human beings at this stage of evolution, the default mode is we're in our lower minds. And so the effort needs to be made to be aware of that and to work in ways that will open our hearts and minds to grander principles and seek out opportunities to be of service. So then, what reincarnates? It's that individuality that reincarnates. And the individuality reincarnates. When it reincarnates from life to life, it's actually different when it leaves this life than when it entered this life. How is it different? Well, everything we do in the sense of our higher aspirations, our spiritual ideas, our efforts to take action and be of service, the karmic, so to speak, the karmic white pearls that come back to the individuality are assimilated. The wisdom, the knowledge, the experience of all the universal things that we do in every life are assimilated into our higher nature. In other words, essentially, that's called character building, isn't it? So who does the character building? It's actually the lower personality. The personality makes the decision on whether or not it's going to make the effort to do so. And through sacrifice and effort to higher principles and right living, we learn and grow in service to others. And that part of us which leaves the body is different and a little more. The substance of the soul is our spiritual experiences in any given life. So that's the idea of what part of us reincarnates. The next part of our presentation will be, well, why? What is the purpose for reincarnation?
In considering reincarnation, the doctrine of hope, it becomes apparent that unless we understand why we reincarnate, it's hard to understand why it would be a doctrine of hope. But even when we ask the question, why reincarnate, there are two aspects to that. One is, why is it necessary to reincarnate? Do we have a choice? And the other thing that we need to understand in terms of why is said is, what is the purpose? What is the opportunity provided through the doctrine of reincarnation that cannot be found in any other attempt to understand hope? So these questions about reincarnation touch upon the entire philosophy of theosophy. And so throughout this month, as we look at basic theosophical principles, this doctrine of reincarnation will be central to our consideration and appear again and again. Now, last week, we looked at universal unity, a basis for universal unity. And we had presented the idea that the rootless root, the causeless cause, the eternal, ever-present one reality behind all manifestation from which everything comes and which everything returns, we might call the deific principle. And the basic idea is this is not a being, but is boundless, universal, one reality, beingness, if you like, the one life, the absolute, whatever term satisfies your mind in terms of understanding that which has no limits. And perhaps the idea of space is helpful to us in considering the nature of deity. Now, in manifestation, because deity itself is unknowable and unmanifested, we have its two aspects, spirit and matter. Spirit and matter are not two independent realities, but two sides, or two aspects, if you will, of the same one underlying reality. So wherever we have manifestation, we have spirit and matter. You can't have one without the other. And spirit might be the origin of all the different degrees of intelligences and forces working behind the scenes. And matter, the origin of all the different degrees of form through which spirit, intelligence, life, force can operate. And so we cannot have the manifestations of those invisible principles of spirit unless there is a form to work through. So from this, we come to the idea, which we might say is the main idea of our presentation this morning. And if you can keep this in mind, you'll have everything in a nutshell you need to know about the doctrine of hope. So all the different degrees of a being are alive, conscious, intelligent, spirit, if you will, and they're all evolving under the rule of law for the purpose of gaining experience. And in those few words, we have the entire month's work before us. So the universe itself manifests for the experience of the soul. And as everything is alive, conscious, intelligent, receptive in its own degree, nothing, no one, no being in any of the departments of nature is left out in this progressive march to wisdom and experience. So that is true of the animal, mineral, vegetable kingdom. But this morning, we're looking more in terms of the doctrine of hope as it relates to the human being. So man is a soul, as we've heard, a self-conscious, individual, intelligent being. And being so, it's subject to the same laws that guide every other department of nature. And that law that we see occurring again and again is the law of cycles, the periodic return of that which has been before. So we see day and night, waking and sleeping, birth and death, the various seasons, the passage of the celestial phenomena, the rhythmic operations in the body. But that applies to the human soul as well. And in fact, re-embodiment occurs throughout nature, because the material forms of nature are continually decomposing into their basic elements and reforming again. And so there is always that continuous re-embodiment. But reincarnation then refers specifically to the reincarnation of the re-embodiment or the individuality, we have heard, the immortal thinker, into a long series of physical bodies, personalities, different physical conditions. And so under this doctrine of ever-recurring cycles, there is no end to the possibility of re-embodiment or the hope for progress and the experience in the human form. So it is hope for those temporary principles we heard about, the human form, the personality with the physical body and our passions and desires and our lower mind. There's hope for that progress, but there's also hope for the progress and development of the individual thinker throughout that long series. So in the answer to the first question, why is it necessary? We see that it's really a process of nature, a law. We cannot choose whether or not we will reincarnate at one point. Everything, the universe, solar system, earth, all the kingdoms of nature will be re-embodied and re-expressed in some form or another. But when we get to this idea, is what is the purpose in the sense of why do we incarnate? What is the opportunity given to us through this doctrine that we may not find in other means of trying to explain or support a doctrine of hope? So we have seen that if there is a sevenfold division of the human being, as every other thing in nature, that nature as well as man has a spiritual, a mental or psychic nature, and a physical nature. So if there is opportunity of progress, it should be along those lines: spiritual progress, progress of our mental nature, our abilities to think and reason and abstract and make connections, not only on this plane, but our higher mental faculties of intuition, of clear seeing, of understanding those abstract universal principles which underlie all manifestation. That's a mental faculty that we need to develop, and reincarnation gives us the opportunity for that. Also included in that psychic nature is our feeling nature, which are at now, for most of us, may be mixed, but we know from the examples of wise, perfected, kind, powerful human beings that have appeared throughout the history of humanity, that it is possible for a human's nature to be completely governed by love, compassion, understanding, powerful will to achieve what needs to be done for the benefit of all. And that all is part of our psychic feeling nature. And of course, we have our physical body and our physical circumstances, which also are important because that's what provides the opportunity, the tool. The immortal thinker has to experience and grow through the opportunities given to it by the physical nature, our circumstances and our physical body. And it does not mean that we focus particularly on trying to develop a better body in the future or a better physical circumstance in the future. As was stated in that reading from Isis Unveiled, as an individual thinker aspires to become more closely united with the divine part of his or her own nature and the divine part of great nature, he's protected, or he finds each succeeding reincarnation less dangerous or more opportune to the fulfillment of that goal. Once we make that effort to work with nature, to become a co-worker with nature, all of nature responds in helping us, seeing us as one of its co-creators, we might say. So that improvement in our physical condition over time, our physical instrument and our circumstances, is the result of the proper life lived, the proper mental and feeling nature. So our purpose for reincarnation is to perfect the lower instrument while proceeding along a long series of lives to gain more experience and self-conscious realization of the unity of all of life, the interconnectedness of all of life, and of course, the true self, the divine self within each and all. But it's not just that. Matter is also part of this process. There is no spirit without matter. There is no intelligence without form. And so the purpose provided through reincarnation is the opportunity to raise up the very nature, the ethereality, the permeability, the sensitivity of the matter we use in our bodies, keeping in mind that there are conscious lives working through all those lower forms of matter and raising them up to the point where in future cycles, the capacity for self-conscious realization will spring forth in them. So no speck of matter is left out, no atom, not even the slightest, smallest conceivable speck of intelligent life that we can think of is left out of the possibility of growth and hope through this process of reincarnation. And most importantly, we might say, re-embodiment, reincarnation is a doctrine of hope for humanity, because we know humanity, or a man, as Shakespeare would say, what a piece of work is man, how noble in reason. And yet, as we look around, we wonder, we have a lot of work to do, and no one life can give that possibility, that hope of growth, of living up to the nobility of our nature, individually or collectively. So it's an opportunity for the individual and collectively as groups of individuals to improve themselves and to lift up the possibility, the hearts and minds of humanity. Because humanity itself is on a long journey throughout a long series of incarnations. And through that process, we'll reach in some future cycle levels of perfection, of use of our mental, psychic, and spiritual faculties, which we can only imagine at this time. So we'll stop here and give you all an opportunity to ask questions or direct your comments to each of the panelists, whether it has to do more with who or what reincarnates or why we reincarnate.
We have a hand raise here in the back, and who are you directing your comment to? Okay.
So if someone says to us, how can you possibly believe in reincarnation? I don't want to come back here. My life is terrible. Why would I want to come back? So how do we respond to someone who is, maybe they're just having a bad day. Maybe their life here is rough. So how do we respond to make it a doctrine of hope then?
Well, one approach that we find to be very helpful is you kind of have to set the groundwork for a discussion like that. And tell the person, you know, when if we're going to look into this and talk about this, then the only way that it makes sense is to have certain ideas as you know are true, which are theosophical ideas. Maybe you think they're true too, but one of them is that everyone, all of us, is an immortal soul. We were alive before this body was, and we will forever be alive after this body is. And each human being, as a self-conscious thinking being, is responsible for everything that they've done. And that can be very hard, can't it? But the law of karma, everything that comes around, goes around, comes around, tells us we're responsible. Now, in this lifetime, we may not understand or have any idea where some of these, so to speak, challenges or negative karma came from, but it doesn't matter. What matters is our grounding in the philosophy that I'm responsible for everything. And that is empowering. Even a modern day Western psychologist looking, trying to find the cause of whatever their patient has, if even if they can't dig and find the cause, it's generally known if the psychologist can get the patient to own it anyway, take responsibility for it anyway, take steps to uplift themselves anyway, it's very empowering. So there's certain premises that we have to approach. And if the friend in this moment, of course, isn't ready to accept those ideas, then we can just plant the seeds and let it go rather than trying to force something because they're not ready for it. Yes, SL, did you have a follow-up?
Well, we'll take JCS's.
Okay, JCS?
Frequently, the point made about the readiness of the friend becomes the overriding idea. And if we, each of us thinks back to how we came to a consideration and an assimilation of reincarnation, it probably started with questions. Why is life this way? And what do I see throughout all degrees of life, all kingdoms of life, that seems to follow the same pattern? So you might say to the friend, you know, it just seems to me that nothing in the universe only ever comes once. So if that's true, if we can look around, let's try to find the thing that only comes once. But if that's not the case, then we need to adjust our thinking to the reality.
Thank you for the contribution. And one point that's made in this contribution that is brought out is when we're responding to a friend in that sense, we want to share the ideas, but we don't want to make them believe it. So as was said in this contribution, you could speak in the manner of, I've been in that place where you are. And what I have found by studying theosophy or by applying these ideas of reincarnation, what I've learned from that, and it alleviated me. If you'd like to talk about that, we could go into it, but that's my answer to it for me. I hope you find the answer too. We could talk about that.
Hold on that. So when we listen to that individual's question or complaint, how can I believe in reincarnation? My life now is so terrible, I wouldn't want to come back. What are they really saying? That reincarnation or not, their life is terrible. And such a person full of hopelessness probably doesn't even want to live till tomorrow or the next day or the next month or the next year, because they don't see any possibility of change, of better improvement. So we might ask the person, well, your life is terrible today. Do you want to live next month? Do you want to live next year? And if they say, yeah, sure. Well, why? Because there's a chance that things might get better. Well, that's the point of reincarnation. Because of the continuous opportunities to experience and grow and learn and possibly understand and improve things, there's a chance things can get better. There's hope that things can get better. Whether we look at one life or 1 month, it's only a matter of duration. The idea is the same. We have the continual opportunity to change our attitude and learn from our experiences rather than just be bound down by them. There is a chat here that perhaps the first panelist can direct.
Okay. We have a hand here in the lodge.
Okay. So. Right.
Here's the first. Do human souls reincarnate into animal bodies? Do animal souls reincarnate into human bodies? Great question. So let's start with this. Do human beings reincarnate into animal bodies? This is a teaching in some sects of Hinduism, and it's broadly accepted, and it will be argued, so to speak, not a big argument, but they have their reasons for believing this. The theosophical teaching is that these bodies into which we incarnate are here because the soul, over the eons of time, has participated literally in the creation and the construction of it. The human form is the only form that is evolved properly in terms of its central nervous system to be of any use to the inner man, to the soul. Only through a human form can the soul fulfill its purpose. For a human being, just the thought of it, to go into an animal. Now, there's an ancient reason of a false teaching of why that goes on. Maybe that'll come out. But simply the teaching is it's completely unphilosophical. Those are the words HPB uses. And it doesn't take long if one dedicates the effort to see the theosophical view. It doesn't take long to see how it's not an issue. It's against nature's law. It's against nature's law. So?
Well, we think it was pointed out in the first talk that it is the mind that is the thinker, the human soul that reincarnates into a human form, because that form is appropriate to that degree of intelligence. The animal forms have an animal soul or an animal degree of intelligence, but they're not capable as yet to being a vehicle for the thinker. And we might take an analogy that a light bulb can support a certain amount of electric power, but just cannot be the proper vehicle for the power that might be generated by Niagara Falls, we'll say. It's just not a suitable instrument. And likewise, that intelligence would not be, in the animal form, would not be strong enough to support the requirements, the energies that are necessary to keep a human body together. So that gets behind the philosophical reasons why once a thinker, always a thinker, always incarnating into some human form of one degree or another.
Thank you. As to the part of the question, do animals incarnate into human forms? Philosophy says very little on it. But the closest we've ever found is that in the successive march through higher degrees of intelligence, that step, that initiation into humanhood, happens behind the scenes during the great period of Pralaya. It does not happen during manifestation. Whatever had, so to speak, been prepared that would become human, it becomes human in the following Manvantara. That's our understanding. Then there was, oh, yes, so there's a hand here. Yes.
Back to that question about a struggling friend asking about reincarnation and using the word responsibility. I think it is important when talking to somebody about that to make a distinction between saying it's their fault and saying it's their responsibility, because without defining that, people then can get very upset, feels like victim blaming. I think a good comparison is if somebody has an illness and they're diagnosed with something and it can be treated and they're able to get it treated, they take the responsibility to either show up for that treatment or not.
Thank you. Very helpful. The point is making the difference between is it your fault or is it, as opposed to it's our responsibility. And that, you know, probably if the person is in the throes of depression in the moment, probably not the time to really get into all of that, but rather through compassion, identify with them and be with them. There's another time to talk about this. There's another hand here in the lodge.
Well, yeah, once a human, always a human, or until we evolve beyond this stage. But as far as actual behavior goes, a human can be far below and more vicious than any animal, which is only acting according to their nature. But humans can act against what really is human nature, which should be beyond where we are now, right?
Yeah, well, therein is the teaching that, you know, in ancient times, in these sects in India, when it would seem they were more focused on the personality than the individuality, their logical conclusion is that a person who acts like that would reincarnate into a lower nature. Now, of course, human beings who act like an animal, unfortunately, we send off these vibrations and the very lives that make up our body into those kingdoms and affect it. You know, just look around the world and how we're affecting very, you know, the weather patterns and all of this. We're responsible for that. But so too are we responsible, and so too do we have the power to lift all of nature. And, you know, as we do that, you know, as we work on ourselves and help each other, so does all of nature rise with us. So
there is a chat that seems relevant to bring in at this point. Just a comment. Reincarnation always made sense to me based on the idea that matter is neither created nor destroyed. But the other side of that is energy is neither created or destroyed. They're interconvertible, meaning that they're interdependent and have one without the other. And so as long as you have something that's neither created nor destroyed, spirit and matter, there can only be a re-embodiment or a re-expression of it. So it's a fundamental physical law, fundamental spiritual law. We might say that all the laws or principles presented to us in theosophy are applicable in all different directions. And that's one of the nice things about discovering the philosophy. We did want to respond to the previous contribution about the distinction between fault and responsibility, and also say that, you know, karma, the doctrine of responsibility, is next week, so we'll see that more. But Krishna makes an interesting comment. He says to Arjuna, at the beginning of chapter 9, we believe, "He who findeth no fault, to him I will reveal this most divine wisdom." And it's always brought up for discussion. What does it mean to find no fault, either in our own lives or in the lives of another? Just throw that out there. to consideration, to find no fault. If we're finding no fault, what are we? What are we seeing then?
Here in the lodge. Oh, and then JCS.
We're seeing possibilities everywhere. The potential that all of life holds. Any of us who have had encouraging and inspiring parents, friends, teachers, we see possibility, we see potential, we see that we can evolve beyond where we are today.
So the contribution has to do with when we find no fault and instead open our minds and hearts to the opportunities that are available, really we're living in a place just of non-judgment. We're living in a place where we learn as we go and we move forward. So the implication here with Krishna, he who finds no fault, I will make this wisdom available. The message is you have to climb out of yourself. You have to climb out of that lower nature. You're the individuality. You're not the personality. Yet the personality is going to look for problems. Personality is going to find fault. We have to put ourselves in that place of compassion and non-judgment.
JCS, have your hand up.
Yeah, the thought occurred that runs parallel to these comments, that as we look around the world, we look at our own behavior. Maybe at the end of every day, we look over the day and see how we did morally and ethically. As we look around the world, frequently the personality has a reaction, a stunned reaction to whatever's being observed. And then the thinker, the eternal self, needs to take that and turn it into a response, a discerning response, not a judgmental response. Difference is that as we discern, we look into the motives and the nuances of action, thought behind whatever evil we're seeing. That becomes a soulful experience, and that becomes a discerning, oh, I get it. I see how human nature can work. There's an empathy. There's a oneness between that soul and this personality and the soul that's operating in the other personality. Very different from the judgmental looking around the world, having the personal reaction of hatred, revenge, etc., and directing that at another person. That's self-centered, selfish thinking, and that's animalistic. Both are opportunities to grow. But a student of this philosophy will make every effort to become more compassionate, discerning, more at one, regardless of the ugliness of what they see around them.
So Krishna there says that he who findeth no fault, I will now make known this most divine knowledge. And what is that divine knowledge? That we are divine in nature, potential gods in nature, in a process of growing to that. So when somebody thinks or believes or says that it's my fault, or is made to believe it's fault, they think that there's something inherently weak or sinful or a fault in their nature. They are inherently incapacitated or not able to do something. And because of that, they committed the offense. Some of that is due to the religious influence of the doctrine of original sin. Some of it is due to the religious influence, is that we are beings, imperfect beings created by an outside perfect being, so we cannot possibly be divine and perfectible. Some of it's from a scientific notion that pervades us, that we are no more than animals guided by mostly by our passions and instincts and tempered with our reason. But this doctrine of reincarnation teaches the opposite, that we are inherently already divine and perfected in our higher nature. Our issue is we have to realize that. We have to grow to that self-conscious realization as incarnated beings of who and what we are. But the perfectibility is already in our spiritual nature. Reincarnation gives us the possibility of self-consciously realizing that.
So we have a few here, a few comments here in the chat. The first of which is, did HPB ever claim to be reincarnated from any specific previously incarnated personality or soul? Well, why would she? We don't know of any time that she did. And certainly we don't know the wisdom behind trying to figure out, you know, oh, I wonder if HPB's back. How would that help us lead a more independent life or self-fulfilled life? So to our knowledge, the answer is no. Is there anyone who has read otherwise? It's not about the personality. It's about the soul, the work the soul does in any given life. And the next contribution, blame is lower nature. Finding fault is lower nature. Responsibility is higher nature. And isn't that exactly what Krishna is saying to he who finds no fault? In other words, to he who finds fault, you're not ready for it. So that would be lower nature. Thank you. Any contributions along that line? And then a scapegoat in family dynamics. What do we mean by that? We're not sure where that's coming from. Yes, SL.
Well, the original idea of the scapegoat was a purification ritual by means of which the community could throw all their sins and therefore all their blame and impurity and faults onto some animal and discard it into the wilderness. It was a type of ritual. And in the same way, a group can do that, or a family can do that, or a variety of groups can do that, where in order to deal with their own perceived faults and weaknesses and sins, they blame or they throw it on some other human being or groups of human beings and can cast them out, get rid of them, can sacrifice them. So it's an attempt for placating one's own guilt and responsibility by blaming it on another, throwing it on another.
Yeah, it's the ultimate avoiding of one's own responsibility, to blame someone out and run them out of town. Yeah, that will fix everything. So then we have another contribution. Do we reincarnate in the same gender, incarnation after incarnation, or do we change sexes? Well, for sure, that which incarnates is no sex. It has the potential to be either sex in any given lifetime and becomes so depending on the conditions that are best for that soul. So really it's entirely dependent upon how the soul has lived in previous lives, not necessarily just the last life, because karma that has not been worked out for the past 1,000 lives will eventually be worked out. So when it's time to incarnate, there is a magnetic tie which draws the soul to specific conditions, people, the nation, perhaps the neighborhood, the family, into conditions that are best for that soul to, at the given point in time, to pick up where they left off. And it may be a male or it may be a female, whichever happens to be there available and best for that soul. That's our understanding. That's the teaching. So?
Nothing to add on that.
Yes, here in the lodge.
Is there a belief about how much time tends to elapse between incarnations?
So the question is, how much time do we spend out of incarnation as opposed to actually in a physical body? And the teaching of theosophy, when we read through, we'll come across the answer to that question. You'll usually see, you'll either read 1500 years or you'll read about 1000 to 1500 years. That being an average for all of humanity, in particular at this stage of evolution. Now, what could possibly change that? Depending on how we live our lives, that can be very different. So what would change it? If we think about it, all the higher experiences and aspirations that we had in our life have to be assimilated into our mortal nature. And we can do that as we live our life through meditation, through conscious awareness, through recognition. The process of assimilation of our experiences goes on in the person who lives a meditative life. But for those who have, you know, high ideals and want to do everything for the world, but never really get around to it, well, they are creating a force in their own nature. And it's like a balloon that's blowing and blowing and growing and growing, so that all of these ideas, the force of these ideas, when they die and go through the after-death states, by the time they make it to that heaven state, it's in that heaven state, which we call Deva, where everything that we haven't assimilated yet during life becomes assimilated. And so for most people, it takes about 1,500 years to assimilate the life experiences that have not yet been assimilated. On the other hand, for the one who leads a more meditative life and does the work along the way, that decreases the amount of time. On the other hand, an adept or a Mahatma, who with each step of their life, they are in the place at the time doing the action that is right according to their soul evolution, and it's all happening simultaneously, well, they're not accumulating this big force of unexhausted energy. So when it's time to put down that body, there's no reason to have this time in between lives, and they can step right back into another body and pick up where they left off. So it really all depends on how we live our life. Now, of course, living a life of extreme selfishness also extends the period of time where we're in this other plane, this lower plane of frustration. And some people will go right through that in a couple of hours or a couple of days. And others, it is said, it could be longer months or some number of years. But we're not putting numbers to it. It's the ideas and the principles that matters, depending on how we live our life. Any along this line, SL?
Yes. No. So because of that general cycle of reincarnation at this time, 1,000 to 1,500 years, it is observed, and to a certain extent can be traceable through our study, that groups of individuals, nations, incarnate together. Egos that have worked together, developed affinities and certain tendencies similar in past cycles, reincarnate together in a cycle of 1,000 to 1,500 years. And so very often we see manifested the same kinds of relationships, conflicts, tendencies, abilities, almost like history repeating itself in the relationships of peoples as these souls come back to pick up where they left off before. But even there, reincarnation is a doctrine of hope because these individuals coming back have an opportunity to correct old debts and continue their mutual efforts in helping one another in this particular incarnation.
So we have a hand here in the lodge.
And also, an adept can recall a soul out of Devakan. You know, if they feel as though this person is able to assist mankind in a better way, he is able to bring that person back. It doesn't have to be 1,500 years.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, so for one who has lived along those principles and is willing to cut it to cut it short, the Mahatma can assist them, kind of like wake them up. And of course, the Mahatma would only do that knowing that this person would live the type of life that is meditative, that will continue to assimilate that little that may not have been assimilated yet. So with that, we know we have other messages, but the time has come. We're at the end of the hour, and please bring your questions back next week, where we're talking about karma, which is interrelated and interlinked with the doctrine of reincarnation. So it would be an entirely appropriate time to ask the same kinds of questions. Okay, so, well, thank you for coming.